Number one New York Times bestselling author Lisa Jackson will chill you to the bone with Ruthless, where simmering just beneath the most idyllic surface are dangerous secrets, bitter jealousy, and those who will stop at nothing to get their vengeance. When it comes to suspense, Lisa Jackson kills it every time. Ruthless is on sale now everywhere books are sold. For more info, visit lisajackson.com. If you're a fan of Court Junkie, you probably enjoy mysteries. And if that's the case, let me tell you about a new podcast I recently discovered called Unexplained Mysteries. Every week, the hosts explore the greatest mysteries of the past and present. From the building of Stonehenge to the subject of the Mona Lisa, there may not be a simple answer or explanation, but that doesn't mean that there's no explanation at all. And these hosts dig deep to investigate Earth's greatest mysteries. So why do I love this podcast? Well, for starters, each episode uses captivating storytelling, and with a team of researchers, the hosts use in-depth research and analysis as they look for answers. I would suggest checking out the episodes on Mona Lisa and Stonehenge now. And with a new episode coming out every Thursday, you can expect episodes on crop circles, dragons, and many more. Visit Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts and search for Unexplained Mysteries. Again, that's Unexplained Mysteries, UnexplainedMysteries, or visit parcast.com/unexplained to start listening now. That's Parcast, parcast.com/unexplained to listen now. And now, let's get started with today's episode.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Mama.
Hello, Jeff. What's going on?
I'm in jail.
Why are you in jail?
From murder in the first degree.
Who'd you kill?
I ain't killed nobody.
It was Sunday, October 24th, 2010, and 19-year-old Jennifer Mee was calling her mom from a jail in St. Petersburg, Florida, to tell her that she had just been arrested and charged with first-degree murder. The night before, at about 11:15 p.m., St. Petersburg police responded to 511 7th Street North. The call was to let them know of a possible sleeping homeless man in a dark alley behind a vacant home. This wasn't an unusual call, and when officers responded to the scene, they expected to find just that, a sleeping homeless man that they would inevitably have to wake up and try to see if he had any other places to go. But that's not what they found when they got to the darkened corner of the alley. As they came upon the shadowy figure lying on the ground, they could tell right away that he wasn't sleeping. He was lying on his side, his pants pulled down below his boxer shorts, his pockets pulled out, and there was red liquid on his chest. The man had been shot multiple times and was quite obviously deceased. Hey everyone, today's case involves a 22-year-old man with his whole life ahead of him when it was senselessly ripped away on that October night in 2010, and a motive that may never be known. It involves a suspect who at one point was a young girl who rose to fame as a charming, relatable teenager and then reemerged just a few short years later, but as something else, a potential murderer. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 49. Investigators divided up their duties at the scene. While one officer put up crime scene tape, another one went to interview people in the neighborhood, while another was taking note of items that were on the ground and that seemed out of place. Like a pair of men's sneakers, a pack of cigarettes, another shoe known as a men's slide, and perhaps the most surprising, a firearm lying in plain sight. Officer Kurt Bradshaw spoke to neighbors in the area and then took inventory of all the vehicles to see if there were any cars or vehicles there that didn't belong to the residents. And sure enough, there was. Across the street from the vacant home was a parked scooter that no one seemed to know who it belonged to. Investigators ran the license plate, and the search results came back with an image of the owner, 22-year-old Shannon Griffin. It was the same man who is now lying dead across the street. Checking Shanann's cell phone records led them to another man, someone Shanann had talked to on the phone, according to those records, right before he was shot and killed. That man was 20-year-old LaRon Rayford. Investigators found LaRon in the company of three friends, his girlfriend, Jennifer Sharone, 22-year-old Lamont Newton, and Lamont's girlfriend, 19-year-old Jennifer Mee. LaRon and Lamont were taken into custody, while Jennifer Mee and Jennifer Sharone voluntarily accompanied police to the station. In subsequent interviews with detectives, LaRon, Lamont, and Jennifer Mee all made admissions that they had been involved in some way, that it had been a robbery gone awry. Jennifer Sharone was allowed to go home, but the remaining three were all arrested and charged with first-degree murder. And that's when Jennifer Mee made that jailhouse phone call to her mom. Just 3 years earlier, in February 2007, a news story made the rounds on popular shows like Good Morning America, Inside Edition, and The Today Show. The star of this news story was Jennifer Mee, who was 15 years old at the time. The teenager from Tampa, Florida, became one of America's sweethearts, seemingly overnight, after she was diagnosed with constant, incessant hiccups that wouldn't stop.
She started hiccuping 3 weeks ago without success. Jennifer is here with her mom, Rachel Robidoux, and Dr. Roshini Raj, a gastroenterologist with the New York University Medical Center. Good morning to you, everybody. I feel so bad for you, Jennifer. I know this started January.
Jennifer, affectionately dubbed Hiccup Girl, was hiccuping about 50 times a minute, nonstop, for about 5 weeks. And although she saw numerous doctors and experts and had several tests done, no one could figure out why it was happening. And then, 37 days after they started, the hiccups finally stopped. So how did Jennifer go from being one of America's favorite teenagers to someone facing murder charges just 3 years later? Jennifer's mom told reporters that the hiccups may be partly to blame where it all started. Shortly after her arrest, Jennifer's mother told a radio show in Tampa that her case of the hiccups wasn't a case of the hiccups. It was a curse of the hiccups. She said that all of a sudden, people knew Jennifer's name and would reach out to her online. She said Jennifer was very naive and that she had started running with a bad crowd. And it did seem as though in the years after Jennifer went viral, long before going viral was a thing, she did have a few run-ins with the police. Officers had been called to her home numerous times after reports came in of her and her boyfriend fighting, and there were rumors that she had been heavily involved in dealing drugs. When news of the arrests for the murder of Shanann Griffin got out, there was particular interest in Jennifer Mee's arrest, since she was the former hiccup girl. And officers weren't shy about letting reporters know what their theory of the case was, that it was a botched robbery, and that it had all been set up by Jennifer Mee.
What we've since learned is that our victim, Mr. Griffin, had a dialogue with Jennifer Ann May, or me, that had started within the last week. They exchanged several back and forth on a social networking site on the internet, led up to a series of phone calls where she enticed him to come down and meet with her at this particular address. This particular address is a vacant house. Mr. Griffin told his family that he was leaving to meet a female about 10 o'clock that particular night. And it was left on a scooter. He apparently drove to this location. We determined that he was probably met by the female out in front of the residence, and they walked behind the residence where he was then accosted by two other individuals, a LaRon Rayford and a Lamont Newton. The purpose of their confrontation with him was robbery. The female, Jennifer Mee, continued to walk, but she was obviously the setup person in this robbery.
The officers then took questions from reporters, all of whom wanted to know more about Jennifer Mee's involvement.
Was Mee aware that someone had been shot during this robbery?
She was aware as it was progressing. The altercation occurred between the three subjects as she was walking away, and she was in the vicinity when the gunshots were fired.
Did she say if she knew they had a gun?
She did. She pointed out the individual. I'm not going to go into exact specifics on that, but she pointed out who brought the firearm there. She knew the firearm was going to be utilized in the armed robbery.
Will she face different charges because she didn't actually fire the gun or because she lured him?
No, she faces the exact same charges as two other individuals. It just depends on how the state attorney's office continues on with any type of agreements down the end. But she'll get charged like she did with first-degree murder, and it'll be handled through the state attorney's office.
LaRon Rayford was the first of the three to go on trial. And just months prior to the start of his trial, he was offered a plea deal, a 40-year prison sentence if he pleaded guilty. But he turned it down and decided to take his chances in court. But with evidence like his DNA on the murder weapon and on clothes found at the scene, he was found guilty and sentenced to life in prison without parole. Now, much ado was made in the media about Jennifer Mee facing the same charges, even though her DNA wasn't on the weapon, meaning that she likely never even touched it or may not have even been present at the time of the actual murder itself. But in the state of Florida, that doesn't really matter, because if she had been involved in committing a felony, in this case, robbery, when the murder occurred, she could still face the same charge as the person who actually pulled the trigger. In his opening statements at Jennifer's trial in September 2013, prosecutor Christopher Labruzzo made sure to highlight that for the jury. "She set everything up," is how he started, and pointed towards Jennifer, who was seated at the defense table. "She set everything up," he repeated. The trial was taking place in Clearwater, Florida, with a now 22-year-old Jennifer Mee seated at the defense table. Before the trial started, however, there was a delay. Jennifer's attorney told the judge that he was concerned that she was suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, and so the judge ordered an impromptu evaluation from a court psychologist. The evaluation concluded that she was competent to stand trial, although the psychologist noted that her intelligence was, quote, low normal. But she was competent, and so the trial got underway. Prosecutor Labruzzo told the jury that Jennifer, LaRon, and Lamont had planned a robbery, and that Jennifer lured Shannon Griffin from his apartment with the promise of selling him marijuana. She used a social networking site called Moco Space to connect with him, and that when Shannon arrived at the vacant home, their designated meeting spot, the suspects didn't have any marijuana to sell, but they did have a handgun with six shots in it. They used this weapon to force property from him. They took his keys, wallet, and cell phone. But Shannon resisted, and there was a struggle over the gun, and so they shot him four times in the chest and then left him for dead in the dark alleyway. Labruzzo told the jury that they would hear evidence that ties Jennifer Mee to the crime, including that phone call to her mom. He told the jury that in that phone call, Jennifer admitted to setting everything up. Labruzzo then explained how there are two ways to prove murder in the first degree in the state of Florida. The first being premeditated murder, which he said isn't the case before them today. But the second is felony murder. In the state of Florida, if you engage in such acts, such as a robbery, and someone is murdered or killed during that robbery, then you are guilty of murder in the first degree. He said that all three suspects in the case, Jennifer Mee, LaRon Rayford, and Lamont Newton, are all principals of the crime, that they had all intended to rob Shannon Griffin. He asked the jury to find her guilty. In his opening statements, Jennifer's attorney, John Trevina, had a completely different version of how things went down, one that potentially made Jennifer Mee a witness, but not a principal. He said that the state alleges that there were three people who were involved, but that there was a fourth person, Jennifer Sharon, LaRon's girlfriend who had gone to the police station with the other three that day, but hadn't been charged. Trevina said they believe that the evidence will show that there's no distinction between Jennifer Mee and Jennifer Sharon, and that Jennifer Sharon was likely the participant who aided LaRon and Lamont, not his client. He told the jury about Jennifer Mee's background, how she had become known as the Hiccup Girl when she was 15. He said the hiccups were part of Tourette's syndrome and that she is now controlling them through medication. When the crime occurred, she was 19 years old and was sharing an apartment with her boyfriend, Lamont Newton, and the other couple, LaRon Rayford and Jennifer Sharone. After the shooting occurred, the four of them sat down to develop a cover story or strategy in an effort to place the most blame on who they thought would be the least likely to suffer the worst consequences, an active attempt to minimize the involvement of certain people and maximize the involvement of others. So what really happened, according to the defense? Well, Jennifer Mee actually gave two statements to the police. And in the first one, she described a love triangle between LaRon Rayford, his girlfriend Jennifer Sharone, and the victim, Shannon Griffin. This is the story that bears the most forensic support, Trevina said. According to this first statement, Jennifer Sharone had been the one texting with the victim and communicating with him on Moco Space, not Jennifer Mee. And when Jennifer Sharone went to meet up with Shannon that night, her boyfriend, LaRon, followed her. He exploded, became enraged, and pulled a gun out after seeing them together. He then shot Shannon multiple times in the alley. Now, Jennifer Mee's second statement to investigators was the one that the state ran with, Trevina said. A robbery gone wrong and a struggle over the gun. Ask yourself if that version makes sense to you. It doesn't, he said. Four shots in a crime of passion, which goes more towards the love triangle story. But police didn't want to accept that. They wanted to know how Jennifer Mee was involved. So according to them, Jennifer Mee accompanies the guys to the vacant home, an intro is made, and then as she's leaving the scene, the victim is shot four times. Trevina said the physical evidence points to the love triangle story. There was a condom wrapper found at the scene, and Shannon Griffin was found with his pants pulled down, unzipped, and unbuttoned. But detectives didn't think that was relevant. He said the, quote, left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing, because while one detective said the condom wrapper wasn't relevant, another one sent it for testing, and LaRon Rayford's DNA was on it. Who brings a condom to a marijuana deal? He asked. Although Jennifer Sharone was the star witness for the state, she was the first one when approached by police to say that she wanted an attorney. And in fact, she was the only one who lawyered up. He said she will admit that she participated in hiding things, cleaning up, and bleaching clothes, all of which is illegal, and she should be charged with at least accessory after the fact, but she wasn't. No charge against her, and no deal was made either. Trevina ended by telling the jury that common sense will lead them to the right decision. Officer Kurt Bradshaw was one of the first officers who arrived at the scene, and he described for the jury what he saw when he got there.
As we're getting closer and closer, you know, your flashlight shines 20 feet in front of you or whatever. We first start seeing articles of a hat, some sneakers, sandals. Eventually, we see the subject, and there's also a gun laying there with the articles before we get to the subject.
What did you think when you saw the gun?
This wasn't just a normal routine call of a subject sleeping anymore.
Could you tell whether or not the individual laying there had any injuries to him?
Yes.
And what, based on your training, what did you believe him to be?
Deceased.
All right. Could you tell whether or not those were gunshot wounds?
Eventually, yes.
All right. But initially, you could just see what?
I could see a circular blood mark in his chest on his shirt.
You mentioned the individual laying there had injuries. Could you determine, based on your training and experience, whether or not he was alive?
He appeared to be deceased. It was pretty evident he was deceased.
What was so evident about it?
He had blood dripping from his mouth and his nose. He had glazed eyes. He had no movement at all. When we first got there, I lifted up his shirt to check to see if, in fact, he was shot. And he had a little bit of rigidity to him.
Okay. And you observed bullet wounds on him?
Yes.
The next witness was Douglas Bolden, Shannon Griffin's cousin. Douglas told the jury that Shannon had moved to St. Petersburg from Mississippi after Hurricane Katrina, and that he had been living with him at the time of his death. He recalled the last time he saw his cousin on the night of October 23rd, 2010.
Could you tell the jurors, was he home that evening?
Yes, he was.
What was he doing?
Well, he was home. It was actually, it was the first day of his 1 year celebration. He had just finished working for Walmart 1 year and he was starting his vacation. So he was real bubbly. He was really excited about earning his first week off. And so he was running around the house. He was planning on going out. You know, we were talking about going to the mall. And then he had told me that he had met someone in online. And next he pretty much blew me off and said that he was gonna, you know, go see a young lady. And that was it. He was preparing for that. And from there he got dressed, put on his best gear. And I mean, all I remember the last from the ending time of seeing him was him smelling like a bunch of cologne. It was just my whole house had cologne in it.
Douglas said that he was excited for Shannon because he had worked hard and rarely went out. He had just recently bought his scooter and was proud of it. On cross-examination, Douglas was asked if he thought Shannon ever smoked marijuana, and he said no. He also said that Shannon appeared to be, quote, sparkling like a kid who was going on his first date. Officer Goodman, a crime scene investigator, went over with the jury what evidence was found at the crime scene, as a video of the scene was shown. Near Shannon's body, strewn about the ground, was a gun with 6 rounds fired, a pack of Newport cigarettes, black and red men's sneakers, a Michael Jordan slide shoe, light-tinted sunglasses, and a black baseball hat. Goodman said he also responded to a residence at 589th Avenue North. This was an apartment the four friends were staying at in the immediate aftermath of the shooting. Goodman testified that inside a ceiling vent, they discovered a white bag with Shannon Griffin's driver's license and cell phone that was in pieces. They also took a prepaid cell phone and a red T-shirt from the residence and sent all items to be processed for fingerprints. Goodman said he then went to the apartment where the four friends lived at 610 Fifth Avenue North. This apartment was in very close proximity to the crime scene. He said when he entered, there was a strong odor of bleach, and at the bottom of a bathtub, he collected clothing that had apparently been bleached. His other involvement in the investigation included going to the police station and collecting buccal or oral swabs from the suspects and collecting swabs from the gun and shell casings. And then the prosecution presented their first piece of evidence that they said tied Jennifer Mee to the crime. Melinda Clayton, the St. Petersburg Police Department latent print examiner, testified that the prints from Shannon's driver's license matched the right index finger of Jennifer Mee. We'll see what other evidence the state has tying Jennifer to the crime right after this quick break from today's sponsors. Driven by the mission to provide a better place to sleep for everybody, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand that is also socially conscious. In fact, for every 10 mattresses Lisa sells, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. They also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. Not to mention, with a patented universal adaptive feel, Lisa is designed for all types of sleepers and features 3 premium foam layers, including 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure, which works for sleepers of all sizes. And now, Lisa is continuing to expand its offerings to include the Lisa pillow, blanket, foundation, and frame. No wonder it's a Forbes top 20 startup to watch. Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free, Available in the U.S., U.K., Canada, and Germany online with free shipping. This 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or you can try it at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City and Virginia Beach, and over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. Get $100 off when you go to lisa.com/junkie. That's LEESA.com/junkie. Imagine what you would do with a crisp, new $100 bill every day. Go ahead and think about it. I'll give you a second. Did you imagine throwing that $100 bill away? I didn't think so. But if you're a woman and you're not investing, that could be like losing a fresh new Benjamin every day. That's why there's Elevest, the online investment platform for women. Invest in specific life goals, such as buying a house, starting a business, or retiring your way on your terms. Elevest gives you a free, customized financial plan based on goals you choose, and shows you how much to invest each month until you reach those goals. And it even sets up recurring deposits to help you stay on track. All you have to do is get started. And now, Court Junkie listeners can receive $100 towards your first funded goal when you sign up with Elevest. Visit elevest.com/court. That's ELEVEST.com/court to receive $100 towards your first funded goal. Janelle Borries was a witness from the Pinellas County Forensics Lab, who specializes in DNA. Her testimony included the following. Swabs from the hammer of the gun found at the scene contained a mixture of at least two individuals. The major contributor was determined to be LaRon Rayford, and testing of the minor contributor was inconclusive. It couldn't include or exclude Jennifer Mee or Lamont Newton. Swabs from the majority of shell casings were consistent with LaRon Rayford. A baseball hat from the scene contained a mixture of at least three individuals. The major contributor was LaRon, and Jennifer Mee and Lamont Newton could not be excluded as other contributors. DNA from Jennifer Mee was found on a white tank top found in a backpack at the scene, and DNA from LaRon Rayford was found on the condom wrapper. Other items were either inconclusive or there were no definitive profile. Borries told the jury under questioning that bleach, extreme heat, dirt, and washing and drying can all destroy DNA. On cross-examination, Borries said that with regard to Jennifer's DNA on the victim's shirt, she could not say for certain that Jennifer had actually touched it and that it may have been transferred there by someone else. An assistant medical examiner testified that Shannon had four gunshot wounds in his chest, as well as abrasions and contusions throughout his body. Robert Michael Schock, an investigator with the state's attorney's office, testified that Jennifer Mee called her mom from booking on October 24, 2010, at 10:08 a.m. The call lasted for 2 minutes and 17 seconds, and the entire call was played in court for the jury.
Hello?
Sippy.
Yeah?
Is mommy up?
No, she goes to the med. Of course. What time did you do it? Be in jail.
I got charged with murder.
What did you do?
I got charged for murder first degree.
Charged for murder in the first degree?
Yes, sir.
What time did you do? Who did you kill?
I didn't do nothing. I was just there at the wrong time, at the wrong place, and I got caught up in it.
So, when did all this happen?
It took place last night, and the police found me today and arrested me today.
Well, it sounds like you're getting your mother on the phone. Hold on.
Hello?
Hi,
Mama.
Hello, Jeff. What's going on?
I'm in jail.
Why are you in jail?
From
first
degree, murder in the first degree.
Who'd you kill?
I killed nobody.
Well, then how are they charging you with attempted murder?
Because I set everything up. It all went wrong, but it
She just went downhill after everything happened, Mom.
Who are you trying to kill, Jennifer?
Nobody. It wasn't even supposed to happen like that, Mom.
Well, something happened. Obviously, Jennifer, you're in jail.
Okay, listen. No, okay. Me and Monica are on, all right? And dude, my mom was saying, talk about you want to ask, all right? So I told him to come meet me over at the park where you can stay at. And the boys brought him into the little alley thing, and my mom pulled the gun out on him. And the guy went to go reach for the gun and pull the barrel. And Mom,
go.
Call you when I can because I gotta go. Mommy, try to make visitation, please.
What is visitation, Jennifer?
You gotta call in the morning and make one.
Where are you at, Clearwater Jail?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, Jennifer, I love you.
I love you too, Mom.
All right, bye.
Bye.
Now, everything she said in that phone call may have been difficult to hear, but the important part that the prosecution wanted to stress was when she says, because I set everything up. It all went wrong, Mom. It just went downhill after everything. Gary Thomas Gibson was working as a homicide detective for the St. Petersburg Police Department in October 2010. He described going to the apartment where the suspects had been staying and apprehending LaRon Rayford and Lamont Newton. He said he then came across Jennifer Mee and Jennifer Sharone outside, who both agreed to come to the police station. He spoke with Jennifer Mee once they got to the station. He said she was not handcuffed and was not under arrest at the time. He testified that he was speaking to her as a witness. Jennifer Mee identified the gun that had been found at the scene and said that LaRon, quote, last week had that gun. She then gave him a statement about what had happened, which he recorded. The statement was played in court. I'll play it here and then clarify what she said afterwards, since it's a little difficult to make out everything she says.
All right, can you tell me from your perspective while you were at the park last night, what you saw and what occurred from there?
I seen, well, when we had left from the apartment, we had walked up to the park, and at the park, the suspect was supposed to meet us, and wherever the kid made, let me rephrase it, she was trying to meet the other Jennifer.
Okay.
Okay. LaRon had no clue that Jennifer and the suspect had...
Well, if you call him the suspect, he's
got that. The victim. I didn't know they had any type of relation going on. And then when LaRon, I guess, found out that he had some type of relation going on with his girlfriend, LaRon snapped, grabbed the man up, choked him, and pulled the gun out of the book bag and put it to the man's head and told the man not the same thing and brought the man to the back of the house and shot him.
Did you hear? How many gunshots did you hear?
I heard two.
Did you see the actual shooting happen or no?
No, sir.
What happened after the gunshots? Tell me what happened.
I didn't stay around. I left. I... like from everything, I didn't know what to do.
Who was all at the park?
It was me, Jennifer, Lamar, and LaRon.
All right.
Now in that statement, Jennifer tells Officer Gibson that the four of them, LaRon, Lamont, Jennifer Sharone, and herself, met up with Shannon Griffin. She said LaRon found out that Jennifer Sharone, his girlfriend, and Shannon Griffin had been engaging in some type of relationship and that he snapped and took Shannon to the back of the vacant house and shot him. She described LaRon's demeanor.
Who got fired off? Who got pissed off?
LaRon did. Because he asked for Jennifer. And he also was asking me because I was sitting next to LaRon.
Right.
So automatically, LaRon knew that it was his chick and snapped. He snapped and was like...
You could obviously see a change in his perspective?
Yes, in his attitude and... everything.
You could obviously see a change in the way he was acting.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
She then said she thought that the plan had been for them to rob Shannon and then leave him alone. As for why Shannon met them in the first place, she said she thought that he had come there to, quote, chill with Jen, I guess, meaning Jennifer Sharone. Officer Gibson said he didn't challenge Jennifer Mee on anything she said, since he was only taking her statement as a witness. Detective Jay Warzynski was the lead detective in the investigation. He was asked to describe Shannon's appearance when he was found deceased.
Could you tell the jurors how he was dressed?
Yes, ma'am. He was wearing a red and white polo shirt, short sleeve polo shirt. Underneath that was a white tank top. He had on a light colored pair of boxer briefs and a pair of jeans.
And
well as white socks, and there was two pairs of, excuse me, there was a pair of basically like basketball shoes.
There at the scene?
Yes, ma'am.
And he didn't have shoes on?
That's correct.
Could you tell from his socks whether it appeared that he had been wearing shoes?
Yes, the bottom of the socks were fairly clean. They did not appear like he'd been walking in his socks for a very long period of time.
And was there anything unusual about his pants that you observed?
His pants were unzipped. They were partially pulled down below where his crotch would be, and both front pockets were pulled all the way out.
And was that indicative to you in your experience at scenes of either homicides or robberies? Was that indicative of anything to you?
Yes, it is.
What is that?
One of the things that frequently happens with robberies is they'll have the victim either disrobe or partially disrobe or completely disrobe, remove their shoes, remove their pants. It allows them an opportunity to where they can give separation between when the robberies ended. The victim has to take the time to get dressed before they can actually pursue them.
Did you notice anything unusual in his hand?
Now, on one hand, he was had wrapped around a New Jersey Nets-like book bag that was attached to his body.
He said there was a white tank top located inside the book bag, which he said was sent off for testing, and which we earlier heard had DNA from Jennifer Mee on it. Later, after the suspects had been apprehended and were at the police station, he interviewed LaRon.
Talk about his demeanor during the interview.
He alternated. He started out very emotional. He was crying. He was had visible signs where he was trying to vomit, to where he would then settle himself. And we allowed him to calm himself down. We gave him something to drink. He then spoke freely. He became very calm and was very cooperative during the interview.
And what did he tell you?
Objection, hearsay, Your Honor.
Come to the bench, please.
He wasn't allowed to say anything specific about what LaRon told him, but he said there were specific things he learned from his interview with LaRon that he needed to ask Jennifer Mee about. So he went to the room she was in and read her Miranda rights. Now, remember that earlier, Jennifer had given a taped statement to Officer Gibson where she detailed how LaRon became enraged about Shannon talking to his girlfriend, Jennifer Sharone. Well, when talking to Detective Warzynski, she said something quite different.
What was her demeanor when you first started talking with her?
She was crying.
And what did she tell you?
We first started talking to her. We asked her basically where she was staying at, and she advised that she'd been staying the last couple of days with Ms. Sharon and her boyfriend, and that she didn't have a job, basically was living, going from hotel and apartments, and then explained to her that she was deeply involved in the matter and she needed to be honest. She then started to sob, and then she stated that she had made contact with the victim, in this case, Shannon Griffin, by telephone. She told us that she had met him on Moco Space approximately 4 days prior to that. Moco Space is a social networking site, which I wasn't aware of at the time until after this. And that she had met him on that site through a friend request. They had spoken a couple of times on Moco Space, but on the 23rd was the first time that she had actually contacted him by telephone. She explained that she didn't have a telephone. She utilized a phone that was belonging to another individual to make contact with him.
She tell you who that phone belonged to?
LaRon Rayford. She stated that they all agreed, herself, that they needed to get some money.
Who did she tell you, they all?
LaRon Rayford and Lamont Newton.
And herself.
And herself.
I'm sorry for interrupting. Go ahead.
She stated that Mr. Griffin had an interest in purchasing some marijuana, approximately a half ounce, which they were going to sell for $55. She advised us they didn't have any marijuana to sell. They were just going to instead take his money. She made arrangements through contacting Mr. Griffin to go ahead and meet there at a certain location. She was utilizing Mr. Rayford's phone. He had access to another phone. They would speak back and forth and let each other know when Mr. Griffin was getting close by. They had agreed upon area where they were supposed to meet. He didn't like that first area. When they first made contact, he was actually closer than they expected, I believe. They then changed it to an area where they were familiar with as well. He drove out of that area. She stated she then took him back to where the two gentlemen were waiting for him.
Where was the area that he was directed to?
The house at 511 7th Street North on the back corner. She said that she could see the two boys that were back there waiting for him, but he couldn't see from the angle that they were at.
Did she say that he came up on his scooter?
Yes, ma'am.
And did she say where he parked it?
In the apartment across the apartment parking lot across the street.
Did she say who directed him to park it there?
She did.
Okay, continue, I'm sorry.
She said that when he went back there, she observed Mr. Newton grab him from behind, Mr. Rayford place a gun to his head, and she took off from that point. She said as she hears a gunshot, as she's running away, and she hears a second gunshot as she enters the apartment, which is number 21.
And did she tell Mr. Griffin anything, any reason why she wasn't going back with him?
She told us that she told him she was going to go look out for the police, make sure the police weren't coming around.
And after she heard the shots, what did she tell you she did?
When she entered the apartment, she said several minutes went by. Mr. Newton returned, and then Mr. Rayford came after him. Mr. Rayford didn't have his shoes on, didn't have the gun with him anymore. He made some statements that they needed to get out of the...
Objection, Your Honor, hearsay.
They left the apartment, went to the apartment where we found them the next day. She said that she told us that Mr. Griffin's belongings were in a clear plastic bag, which she thought were in the backyard of that apartment.
And in fact, did you have somebody go back to that apartment?
Yes, we did.
And were they able to locate the victim's property at that apartment?
Yes, ma'am.
And where did they locate that property?
They're in a ventilation opening for a fan in the bathroom of the apartment.
Now, was this initial interview taped?
That one was not, no, ma'am.
After you conducted this interview, did you offer her the ability to give a tape statement?
Yes, we did.
And did she agree to give that tape statement?
Yes, ma'am.
Jennifer then tearfully repeated what she said to Detective Worzynski. That taped statement was played in court, but I'm only going to play snippets from it because it's a little hard to understand her through her crying.
Okay, let's back up a little bit. The MOGA, what is that?
MOGA space.
MOGO, M-O-G-O space.
MOGO, with a C.
M-O-C-O space. Okay. That's how you met Shannon?
Yes, sir.
And you've known him for how long?
We've talked, I want to say possibly 4 days.
Okay.
He sent me a friend request, and we were talking. The first time I had met him, he also wanted some weed, but at that time, I don't know, but I didn't follow through with it, and then last night, I finally followed through with it and gave him Laurent's phone number and told him to call me when he was down this way.
Now, what were the intentions when you gave him Laurent's phone number? Was there any intention to sell him any weed?
No, sir. The intention was for the boys just to rob him, and that was
it. Okay. So he comes down there, and when he first comes down there, where is he at?
He is, when he first comes...
He calls you, and where is he at?
The Coliseum.
And where are you at?
I was at the 5th and 7th at the playground, my playground.
Okay, you told him to come over there?
Yes, sir.
And you told him what, to park his scooter?
Yeah, I told him to park his scooter in the driveway.
Where we found it?
In the one little house next to the park.
Yeah, I guess.
Right next to the Alpha House.
Okay, and then you come down and meet him there?
Yeah. Oh, no, I'll ride down there.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, you might as well say I came down there to meet him.
And then you start walking towards 5th Avenue?
When he parks his scooter, I walk toward the house where I seen the boys standing.
And that's a vacant house?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
He didn't know. Yeah, the two-story peach house. And when I seen the boys, I had told him that the boys will help him with what he needs. And that's when I walked around the back, and then I started walking up
the... Walk around the back where?
Of the house.
Oh, so
I could come onto the sidewalk.
Okay.
And then when I was walking up the sidewalk, I stood at the end of the street right there waiting to cross. And when I heard the first gunshot, I ran across. And then I heard the fucking gunshot when I got to the top of the stairs. And I ran in the house and locked the door and sat in there till the boys came back up. And that's when the law started screaming. He shot and killed the man. And that we had to all get our shit and leave. And that's when we went to the apartments off of 5th and 89th. And that's where we stayed all night until this morning.
After she gave that statement, Jennifer Mee, Laurent, and Lamont were all arrested and charged with first-degree murder. On cross-examination, Detective Worzynski said that Jennifer Sharone was very uncooperative in her first interview, but that when he spoke with her again, she allowed them to search their apartment, and she was cooperative then. He said at no point was she a suspect in the investigation. He said the only information he was able to obtain from MOGO Space, the social networking site they used, was that the three suspects had accounts. He wasn't able to access any messages between them. Trevina then pointed out that they could not prove that Jennifer Mee sent any text messages to Shannon and then pressed him on the forensic evidence against her.
But ultimately, you weren't really able to get any reliable forensic data that you could bring into court and show the jury and say, see how this connects to Jennifer Mee? We know she sent this text.
With texting, no, sir. There are two areas where forensically she's attached two items.
Okay. Let's talk about that.
Yes, sir.
Because this entire case, if I understand correctly, there's two forensic items and only two that tie to Miss Mee.
Yes, sir.
That would be the fingerprint that was on the driver's license of the victim that was recovered from the apartment.
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, you would have to admit that that fingerprint could have been transferred to that license afterward when the items were brought back to the apartment. What happened? Who is this guy? What did you do? Touches it? Isn't that equally plausible?
I can't put a date or time stamp to when the fingerprint is attached. That's correct.
Okay. So that's not exactly reliable evidence that she committed a crime.
True.
It only means that she touched that license at some point, which we don't even know.
Which she has familiarity with the license. Yes, sir.
Okay. The other piece of physical evidence, I'm assuming, is the DNA you're talking about.
On the tank top, yes.
Right. On the tank top, which was contained in the blue New Jersey bag that was owned by and brought to the scene by someone in the apartment.
Yes, sir.
Their apartment. Me, Newton, Rayford, and Sharon.
Yes, sir.
So again, there's nothing about that item in and of itself that says she committed a crime, isn't it?
By itself, no, sir.
Right. So neither of those, even together, would be sufficient. I'm sure you would agree. That wouldn't even rise to nothing more than a hunch. Wouldn't you agree?
That's why they were corroborative, yes, sir.
All right.
Trevina pointed out the shoes, the gun, the fact that he was shot at six times, and how that was all abnormal for a robbery. He also said that Jennifer Sharon admitted to pouring bleach on the clothes and helping to cover up after the fact. Detective Wozinski said he didn't know that he hadn't read any of her statements unless they were given directly to him. He admitted that he could not rule out the possibility that Jennifer Mee's first story about the love triangle was true.
Now, I want you to think carefully while I ask this very important question. As we sit here today, you cannot rule out that possibility, can you, sir?
I cannot.
After Detective Wozinski's testimony, the prosecution then rested. Jennifer Sharon was called to the stand by the defense. Due to a medical condition, she was now confined to a wheelchair. She testified that she was living with her boyfriend, Laron, Jennifer Mee, and Lamont Newton on October 23, 2010, and that she was pregnant with Laron's child at the time. She told the jury that she was working at a spa facility and that as part of that employment, there were sex acts that she would perform in exchange for money. She said she made a pretty decent living and was paid extremely well. Money was not a problem for her, and she noted that Jennifer Mee had money as well. On Saturday, October 23rd, she got home from work at about 9:15 p.m. Lamont, Laron, and Jennifer Mee were all there, dressed and ready to go out. They all had plans to go see Paranormal Activity, but she said she had to shower and get ready first. Jennifer Mee was talking to someone on Laron's phone, and she told her that she had to go get some money in the meantime. She said Jennifer Mee then left the apartment within a few minutes, and shortly after, Jennifer Mee called Laron. She saw the guys put their shoes on and take a bag out of the closet. They then left too. Jennifer Sharon said she thought that they were going to take care of something first before they all went out, and that she didn't know what was in the bag. She said that she was aware that the guys owned a firearm, a .38 caliber revolver, and that she, Laron, and Lamont had all taken turns handling the gun at some point. After the guys left, Jennifer Sharon was alone at the apartment. About 10 to 15 minutes later, Jennifer Mee came running up the stairs, saying that she had heard gunshots. She was in a panic and seemed overwhelmed. Jennifer Sharon asked where LaRon and Lamont were, and Jennifer Mee said she didn't know. Jennifer Sharon quickly got dressed and went to go see if she could find where the guys were. She got to the apartment steps when she saw LaRon coming up the stairs.
Tell us what you observed about Mr. Rayford as he was coming up the stairs.
We got back in the apartment and I had noticed he was missing his shoes and he was extremely upset, screaming that...
What type of shoes did he have when he left?
He had just put on some Jordan flip-flop slides real quick before he had left.
All right.
And he was also in a panicked mode, screaming that bro, meaning Lamont, and had been shot and was dead. He was under the impression that Lamont was...
So he told you, Mr. Rayford, that Lamont Newton was shot.
Correct.
Okay. And I'm sure that probably caused you then to become upset.
Yeah, and it was a really highly emotional time for the three of us. LaRon actually punched a hole in the wall and...
That was what I was going to ask next. Did you then, when LaRon meets you coming up the stairwell, did you, the two of you, then go back and re-enter the apartment?
Yeah, we went into the apartment. He had locked the deadbolt on the front door, and he had hit the wall and was basically yelling that bro was dead, bro was dead.
About a minute or two later, she heard banging on the door. It was Lamont, who wasn't able to get in because it had been deadbolted. She said he was disheveled, bleeding, had cuts and bumps on him. It appeared as though both guys had gotten into a physical fight with someone. They were pretty scuffed up, she said. She noticed that the guys didn't have the bag they had taken with them anymore. LaRon was missing his shoes, and one of them was missing a hat. She said the guys took their clothes off and they put them in the bathtub. She said someone, she doesn't know who, poured bleach on the items to get rid of any physical evidence. About a half hour later, they all left and went to stay at her friend Portia's apartment. Portia was going out but gave them the keys. The next morning, Jennifer Sharon went to work and left everyone at the apartment. At some point, detectives called her at her work. She said she hung up on the detective, took the battery out of her phone, and purchased a prepaid cell phone. She then went back to Portia's apartment, where everyone was hiding out at. She saw that there was a cell phone, a wallet, and a person's ID on the bed in Portia's bedroom. She said she picked them up and looked at them. Later that day, she and Jennifer Mee were walking back from the store to the apartment when they were stopped by an unmarked police car, asking them where LaRon was and what had happened. They read her her rights and sat her in the back of a police car. She immediately asked for an attorney. She said they did the whole good cop, bad cop routine on her. One told her that she was going to jail for accessory after the fact and for hindering an investigation and obstruction. Another detective took a softer approach, took her handcuffs off, and said that they were just trying to find LaRon. She maintained her silence and was transported to the police department. While this happened, Jennifer Mee was standing nearby talking to another officer. She wasn't put in handcuffs. She was cooperating. Once at the police department, she was brought to an interrogation room. A detective brought Jennifer Mee into the room too, and they were allowed to talk. Jennifer Sharon said she ultimately gave statements to the police and then went home. The defense then rested, with Jennifer Mee declining to testify. In their closing arguments, prosecutors again played the jailhouse phone call from Jennifer Mee to her mom. Prosecutor Labruzzo then said that two crimes had occurred, robbery and murder. There was evidence that Jennifer Mee had lured Shannon Griffin. She says it in her phone call and to the detectives, he said. Shannon was left in the alleyway, and so was a lot of property from the suspects. But what wasn't there? Labruzzo asked. Shannon's keys to his scooter, his cell phone, and his wallet. Did a robbery occur? Evidence should suggest to you that it did. He referenced the photo of Shannon with his pockets emptied out. Someone went through his pockets and took his wallet, cell phone, and keys, and that property was ultimately found in an apartment about 5 miles north of where he was located. Did a robbery occur? He asked again. Yes. Labruzzo then explained how the law works in Florida. The two types of murder in Florida are premeditated and felony murder, which is what this case is, he said. And to prove it, there are three elements that the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. One, that the victim is dead. Two, that the death occurred as a consequence of and when Jennifer Mee was attempting to commit a robbery. And three, although he was killed by a person other than Jennifer Mee, both of them were principals in the commission of a robbery. He described being a principal as saying that if Jennifer Mee helped another person commit or attempt to commit a crime, she is a principal and must be treated as if she did all the things that the other person did, as long as, one, she had a conscious intent that the robbery be done, and two, she did or said something that incited, caused, encouraged, or advised another person to commit the crime. She does not have to be present when the crime was committed to be a principal. Labruzzo said that Jennifer was using LaRon's phone to communicate with Shannon, and that when Shannon left his apartment, he thought he was going on a date. There was no evidence that he was going to see a man. He was going to meet Jennifer Mee. He addressed Shannon's pants having been pulled down and said that LaRon and Lamont could have been trying to take his pants off to buy them some time after they robbed him so he couldn't chase after them. Or maybe they wanted to steal his pants too. As for that condom wrapper with LaRon's DNA on it, it's right around the corner from LaRon's apartment, Labruzzo pointed out. He could have had sex with someone in that alleyway before. Does it make sense that he had been there previously and knew that it was a good place to commit a crime? Sure. He addressed Jennifer's first story about the love triangle and noted how quick she was to change it. The two other charges the jury was being allowed to consider was accessory after the fact and manslaughter, neither of which Labruzzo said applies to this case. He said accessory after the fact isn't applicable because this whole case is not about what happened after the fact. It's about the things that brought Shannon there that night. Jennifer Mee was the first one out of the apartment. She had LaRon's phone and told Shannon where to meet them. And it isn't a manslaughter scenario either, he said, because the facts of this case fit clearly with felony murder based on a robbery. While Trevina gave his closing arguments, Jennifer Mee cried at the defense table as he spoke. Trevina again said that the state's theory about a drug deal robbery was wrong. He pointed out that the toxicology report reported no trace of marijuana in Shannon's system and that he was a stable Walmart employee, which has a no-drug policy. He was not going to purchase marijuana that night, he said. He told the jury that LaRon got wind of communication Jennifer Sharon was having with Shannon online. I pray and hope that you will give every consideration to what the defense has said in this case and consider the gravity of the situation, he said. After about 4 hours of deliberations, the jury had their verdict. Guilty of first-degree murder. The judge then sentenced her to life in prison without parole. Jennifer sobbed as she was walked out of the courtroom, on her way to spending the rest of her life in prison. The third suspect in the case, Jennifer Mee's boyfriend, Lamont Newton, went to trial 3 months later and was also found guilty of first-degree murder. He, too, was sentenced to life in prison. And that's all for this episode. I'd love to know what you think about this case. Do you agree with the felony murder law in Florida? Or do you think that Jennifer Mee should have faced a lesser charge for her involvement? Let me know by joining my discussion group on Facebook at courtjunkie.com/Facebook, by tweeting me at courtjunkie on Twitter, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. As a reminder, if you'd like to hear these episodes earlier than everyone else and ad-free, you're in luck. You can get exclusive access to a feed that will allow you to do just that by donating as little as $1 a month to this podcast. Just go to courtjunkie.com/support. That's courtjunkie.com/support. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.